You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. The FBI seizes documents from the former president's Florida home. Trump takes the Fifth, and Democrats work to pass a sweeping health care and climate change bill. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the U.S. House of Representatives is poised to pass the Senate's Inflation Reduction Act today. That's the bill that includes, among other things, more than $370 billion in funding for mitigating and adapting to the effects of climate change. Paying for it, there's a couple things built into the bill. Among them, an alternative minimum tax on corporations making above a certain amount of money, also an excise tax on businesses buying back their own stock. One thing that did not make it into the bill, an effort to at least partially change a lower tax rate for something called carried interest for investment managers. We're looking at the tax angles in the new bill, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these ideas, the idea of a minimum corporate tax for the largest corporations to make sure they pay something at the end of the year? How about additions to staffing at the IRS? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Rosenthal is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He practiced tax law in Washington, D.C. for over 25 years and was a legislation counsel with the Joint Committee on Taxation. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Let's talk first about something that's not in the final version of the bill. It was in a little earlier, got a lot of attention, this idea of carried interest and the tax on it. First of all, what is that?
Well, carried interest is compensation to an investment manager, typically private equity managers, and they get a share of their fund's profits, the fund that they manage, and they report that share of profits at the lower 20% capital gains rates. So in effect, they earn compensation taxed at 20% rather than 37%. Quite a good deal for them.
What was the change originally envisioned in the first compromise agreement in this bill before it got taken out?
Well, in 2017, the Republican Congress tried to tackle carried interest by limiting the circumstances in which a private equity manager could report that lower tax of 20%. The fund would have to hold the assets for 3 years. That turned out to be too short because a fund typically holds assets for 5 to 7 years, so it was ineffective. The Democrats wanted to lengthen that holding period from 3 to 5 years and delay the start of the clock until the fund had made substantially all of its investments. So it basically closed a loophole that allowed fund managers to continue to get their 20% profits without having to pay the higher 37% rate. But that was shut down.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the politics of this? I know Donald Trump, when he was a candidate for office, talked about getting rid of this. Some Republicans have, some Democrats have over the years. It seems like you could, you know, make a case that this targets hedge fund managers who don't always have the greatest PR. Why does this keep not happening in these big bills?
Well, the managers are incredibly powerful. They have a very powerful trade association, a couple of them, the Private Equity Council, and then separately the Managed Fund Association. And these funds, especially private equity funds, have companies that they own and manage across the country. So they're virtually in every district. And one of the states in which private equity is particularly active is Arizona. And Senator Sinema, and I can't speak to why, but she favors private equity managers and their carried interest. She defends it. And as a consequence, the Democrats lost one of their 50 votes. This bill that's pending has been able to squeak by the thinnest of margins, 50-50 in the Senate, with Kamala Harris casting a tie vote. The Democrats couldn't afford to lose Sinema, so they conceded the carried interest again.
Okay, that's what isn't in it. Let's check out some of the things that are in it. An alternative minimum tax on some of the biggest corporations. What would that do, assuming this is ultimately passed and signed?
Well, Every year, there are news reports that many corporations pay no taxes or very few taxes, notwithstanding the fact that they report very large amounts of income to their shareholders and creditors. And so this alternative tax would make sure that if a large corporation had more than $1 billion of income, they would pay at least 15% of tax on that income. And that income would be determined by the financial reports, those reports that are shared with creditors and shareholders, not determined by taxable income. Taxable income has a lot of allowances and deductions, maybe even some loopholes, you could say. And that allows many corporations to avoid tax. But with this 15% minimum tax, fewer can avoid paying tax.
We are talking about the tax-related provisions in this big bill, waiting for a vote in the House. Steve Rosenthal is with us from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'd like to hear your guest's kind of view on my comment that we in America have the golden rule as far as our tax policy, which is that them that has the gold rules. For example, the vast wealthy people in this country, the multi-billionaires or multimillionaires, they never pay any tax because they inherit vast wealth with little or no inheritance tax. Then they don't earn anything because they simply borrow on the vast assets that they've inherited, and you don't pay tax on a loan. And then they die and pass off their vast wealth to their successors. Plus also, for example, Social Security tax only is taxed, I believe, to the first $150,000 or $120,000 of income, which means a person can be making multi-million dollars, but they only pay FICA on the first $110,000. So I'd be interested in your guest's comments on what I believe is a totally jury-rigged system of taxation. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. Steve, I don't think any of that's tackled in this bill, but do you have thoughts on that?
Oh, sure, I have thoughts. Your listener described what is known as the buy, borrow, and die strategy. And it's especially a good strategy for some of our most wealthy billionaires who found their company and have very appreciated, valuable stock. And when they die, they pass on that stock to their heirs without any income tax ever being paid on the stock. President Biden, when he was on the campaign trail, promised to close that down and, in fact, sent to the Hill a proposal to tax unrealized gains at death. I thought it was a very sensible proposal. It closed a big loophole and could raise a lot of money. But that proposal never made it out of the House. It took on even more flack than carried interest. And so, you know, hard to say exactly why we can't get progressive legislation, tax legislation through. It's very, very hard. There are other great ideas that fell from the legislation, a surtax for millionaires, things of that sort. But again, the Democrats have the most thin of margins, 50-50 in the Senate. They needed every vote, and some of those votes weren't going to come along with aggressive tax increases on the rich.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about provisions in the Federal Inflation Reduction Act. Before the House today, they would affect the tax on large businesses, corporate stock buybacks, and other things. Steve Rosenthal is with us from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the so-called carried interest loophole? Do you wish it had stayed in this bill, a change to that? How about stock buybacks? We'll be talking about that in just a few moments. Do you think the tax system should be set up to discourage big corporations from doing that? How about the corporate minimum tax? Other thoughts on tax changes you would or would not like to see at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Steve Rosenthal, Senior Fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We're looking at tax changes in the Inflation Reduction Act. It's before the House today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you've been hearing about this bill as it relates to taxes, this corporate minimum tax for larger corporations, taxes on stock buybacks, increasing the number of IRS officials, both agents and people who answer your phone calls there? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, let's get to this tax on stock buybacks. What does this do?
Sure. A buyback is a repurchase by a corporation of some of its outstanding stock. And after the last tax bill, the Republican 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there was a flurry of buybacks, $1 trillion or more. And as a consequence, many politicians, both Republican and Democrats, were angry with the corporations buying back their stock rather than using the larger after-tax profits to invest in their workers and their U.S. plants and equipment. And so there were proposals to prohibit buybacks, but where Congress settled and where the bill is now is a 1% excise tax on buybacks.
What kind of impact do you see that having? Is that something that would stop these stock buybacks and motivate corporations to do things like raise salaries or invest in capital equipment or that sort of thing?
That would be the hope of the politicians. But 1% is rather low. And the other problem is corporations, when they have extra cash, can distribute that cash either through a buyback or through a dividend. And so many corporations may just avoid the 1% tax by distributing their earnings, their profits out as dividends. Again, those amounts will not be invested in U.S. workers and U.S. equipment if that happens. So it's a little unclear what the result will be here.
You've written, I think, elsewhere that stock buybacks could have a disproportionate benefit for foreign investors, for people investing from outside of the United States. Do I have that right?
You have that right. I've been doing research for several years to show the increasing share of U.S. stock held by foreigners. And that increasing share held by foreigners coincides with the buyback phenomenon. And I don't think that's a coincidence completely, because foreigners are tax-free when they sell their stock, and they pay maybe a 30% withholding tax if there's a dividend. So foreigners especially prefer corporations to buy back stock. The foreigner could sell their stock in the buyback, or alternatively, the foreigner could sell their stock later. But in either circumstance, the earnings, the profits that are distributed, are not paid out in the form of a dividend, which could be subject to a 30% tax in the hands of the foreign shareholder, but instead the foreign shareholder avoids any tax and may ultimately exit the company without paying any tax at all. And that's all because of the difference between the way we tax capital gains of foreigners, we don't, and the way we tax dividends that are paid to foreigners, and we do at 30%.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mitchell is with us in Webster. Mitchell, hi.
Hi. I guess I just had one question and a small comment. From what I've heard so far, we seem to be focusing on really trying to squeeze as much tax revenues out of people as possible. And now that this current bill seems to be really focusing on getting tax revenues out of a smaller percentage of people. And I was just really curious, is there anything in the bill or is there some sort of focus right now on really getting rid of taxes, minimizing taxes, and kind of helping the economy through, more money in everybody's pockets?
Mitchell, thanks for the call. Steve, your thoughts on the idea of let's minimize taxes in hopes of, Mitchell says, boosting the economy?
Well, I'm not too sure reducing taxes would boost the economy. It might have a short-term stimulative effect, but taxes are the price of democracy. Our government spends a lot of money on programs that we all demand, whether it's Social Security or whether it's national defense or protection of our health. And those cost money, and we use taxes to pay for it. Interestingly, if you look to a comparison of the U.S. to any other major industrial country, the U.S. has a smaller taxes as a percent of GDP than any of our counterparts, industrial companies. So I don't think we're overtaxed. In fact, we're undertaxed. But your listener has made a good point. Mitchell makes a good point that we're trying to squeeze more out of fewer. This package concentrates on the rich and corporations because Joe Biden made a pledge that no household making less than $400,000 a year should pay any additional taxes. And so because of that pledge, he could only go after the highest income and corporations. And he may yet want to return to that, but actually our tax needs are so large, in my view, eventually we're going to have to go after the upper middle class as well.
Mitchell, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Steve Rosenthal, senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, looking at tax-related stuff in this bill before Congress. They've called it the Inflation Reduction Act. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, another tax-related part of this is funding for the IRS, funding agents, for one thing, to do audits, but also funding people to answer phones. If anybody, I had to call the IRS because there had been a mistake. Took a lot of time on hold. I think there's a lot of frustration with that. Can you talk about that part, that aspect of this bill?
Sure. The pending bill authorizes $80 billion to spend at the IRS over the next 10 years. That's a lot of money. The Congressional Budget Office estimated, though, if we spend $80 billion, the IRS could bring in $200 billion. So the spending actually will result in a net profit for the government or a net benefit for the government. Now, the question, though, is, well, is that a net benefit for the rest of us? Because there'll be more taxpayers under audit and more taxes presumably collected. And so that's a difficult question. As I explained to the last listener, President Biden pledged not to collect more taxes from those making less than $400,000. So notwithstanding this large budget increase for the IRS, Secretary Yellen has promised that the IRS will not go after the lower income taxpayers, but focus on at the highest income taxpayers and corporations. And of course, when we talk about $80 billion for the IRS, it's not all for enforcement. Only maybe half of it is. The rest is for things like you've described, taxpayer support, modernization of computers, things of that sort, all of which is desperately needed. The IRS budget in nominal terms has been pretty much frozen since 2010. In real terms, it's down 20%. And so we keep adding more responsibilities to the IRS, but giving them less money. And that's a problem. And the Democrats are trying to reverse that.
I've heard an argument, Steve, that people in wealthier tax brackets are in some ways under audited because, you know, if I make a false claim on a 1040 EZ, it takes one agent about 10 minutes to figure that out. If I, you know, route my money through the Cayman Islands through a complex series of front companies, it takes a lot of agents a lot more time to do that. Is that part of what's trying to be tackled here?
Yes. Because if you draw your income from salary or from interest on a bank account, you'll get W-2s, 1099s, and the IRS can match what you report on your tax return to what information reports they get from your employer and from the bank. And the highest income taxpayers have much more complicated returns, tax returns. They don't just get information returns from an employer. Oftentimes, they're involved in an operating business, whether it's a partnership or a sole proprietorship. And those are very, very hard to audit. And in my study, I don't think it's so much that the rich are hiding money offshore, but rather the rich can avoid taxes, reduce their taxes in different ways, take aggressive positions with respect to gray areas of the law, or maybe have their alter egos, the partnerships, or even the corporations they invest in, take aggressive positions. And so I think that's where the problem is, not so much the offshore hiding of amounts, but just it's very, very hard to sort through these complicated structures, and then it takes years of litigation to collect. Hopefully, with some of that $80 billion, the IRS will hire sophisticated auditors and litigators to go after those amounts.
in our last minute or so, was there something on your wish list in this bill, Steve, that that didn't make it here?
Well, I mentioned before, I would have liked to see loopholes closed, like taxing unrealized gains at death. That was a big one. But I also want to see corporate tax rates go up as well. We're trying to backdoor an increase by going after those very, very large corporations that don't pay a 15% on their financial reports. There's only 150 of them. There's a bigger issue in that U.S. corporations overall are paying much lower taxes as a consequence of ex-President Trump slashing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21. Biden on the campaign pledged to return it to 28, and initially it was going to be returned to 26 when the House Tax Rating Committees reported out their bill. But reports are that Sinema objected to raising corporate tax rates, and so we included an alternative minimum tax, which is a lot more complicated, raises less money from fewer taxpayers.
We'll leave it there, Steve. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's Steve Rosenthal, senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We talked to him today about tax provisions as part of the Inflation Reduction Act before the U.S. House today, aimed at raising revenue to fund some of its climate initiatives. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, are you overwhelmed by zucchini? For this week's edition of Food Friday, we have a guest who helps us get creative with all that extra produce. First, when you think of the Midwest, what comes to mind first? The Washington Post recently set out to determine what places and things are the most Midwestern using hard data analysis. Sort of. Their data columnist built a database of Airbnb rental listings across the country to analyze the text and see what words they used most often, and then use that by region to define places like the Midwest. Iowa, Indiana, and Wisconsin were the three most Midwestern states. That's based on how often these listings mention the word Midwest. Then the Post took it a step further and looked at which words appeared the most in these listings across the 12 Midwestern states to find out which things were most Midwestern. We're putting that to the test with a highly regarded expert on the subject, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What says Midwestern to you? Do you think Wisconsin is the most Midwestern state? Why or why not? Did you move to the Midwest from somewhere else? What stood out to you the most about Wisconsin in particular or about Midwest living? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Behrens is a comedian who hosts the Manitowoc Minute. He's author of the book, The Midwest Survival Guide, How We Talk, Love, Work, Drink, and Eat Everything with Ranch. He performed this week at the Wisconsin State Fair. That's pretty Midwestern. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Well, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back. And, you know, I hope you got the last time you had me on, I did send you that care package in the mail. Did the rhubarb make it?
Loved it. Loved it. So we could go on a half hour like this. That's the most Midwestern thing I could think of. All right. Now, Charlie, but in this data from the Washington Post, they looked at this Airbnb data. The number one most distinctive thing in the Midwest on these listings, walleye, the fish. What do you think? Pretty Midwestern?
Well, that's, you know, if I were to think of some, that would probably be up there pretty near close to top. I mean, I've been fishing walleyes, honestly, since I was first there to fish, when I first started fishing, right off the dock in Fond du Lac, Lake Winnebago, and we catch them all night long. In the early summer, early June, that's when you get them. And, yeah, fishers love them.
Now, I'm not a fishing guy, but I'm a fish-eating guy, and I do love walleye fish fry. Now, I think fish fry has to be on our list of Midwestern things, too. I don't think it was in this list from the Washington Post. I put it there, though. How about you?
Yeah, and you know, a fish fry, and I didn't know this growing up in Wisconsin, but it's a very Wisconsin thing, and it's not as prevalent outside of Wisconsin. It's kind of like bubbler to a certain degree, you know? But to me, there's nothing more Midwestern than fish fry, and I honestly still don't know if I I believe the fact that they're not anywhere other than Wisconsin. But hey, if that's the case, I'm glad Wisconsin is paving the way for the fish fry, because there's nothing better than that, assuming you have your Peps at AC.
Definitely. Now, I grew up in Michigan and then came to Wisconsin. You could find fried fish, and you could often find it on Friday. It wasn't, at least in my part of the state of Michigan, it wasn't the thing it is in Wisconsin. This was an institution I saw when I came here. It wasn't that in southeastern Michigan. So I agree.
Yeah. But we should spread it over there. You know, I mean, they're missing out, you know. It should be more of a perch or walleye kind of place, in my humble opinion.
We've got some callers at 800-642-1234 with thoughts on what is Midwestern. Josh starts us off in Duluth. Josh, hi.
Hey, how's it going? One of the most Midwestern things I think you could think of is a whole segment dedicated to zucchini on your local public found here.
You got us. Are you a zucchini fan, Josh? I know you're joshing us a little bit, but do you like the stuff?
I'm a zucchini fan, and I'm actively tuned in too. So that's the other thing is I'm gonna look at that.
That's thanks for the promo, Josh. Yes, zucchini coming up. I don't know, Charlie. What other foods? We talked fish fry. What other foods leap to mind when you think of Midwest?
Well, you know, the zucchini is a good one because it's a lot of stuff you're growing in the garden. So, you know, you got the zucchinis and the cucumbers and whatnot, obviously. But then outside of that, cheese curds. I just came from the state fair, so I'm just thinking about everything deep fried and on a stick, honestly. But, you got your casserole, and then you got the casserole versus hot dish argument. You know, and that, and I know we're not trying to get political here, but that's a real political conversation, sure. Right? I mean, that'll break up a family over Thanksgiving, you know, if you call Aunt Linda's casserole a hot dish. Them's fighting words. So you got to be careful with it, too.
Now, last time we were on, we talked about your book, and something I loved about your book, we talked about this a little, is, you know, there's a couple ways. You could say, okay, Midwestern, you know, it's kind of an exclusive thing. You're not from around here, so you don't get it. You take a different approach where you include a lot. The stereotypical things we might think about the Midwest, you also say, hey, we got cities in the Midwest. Prince is from the Midwest. We've got a lot of great music, a lot of other traditions. And I don't know, you invite people, I think, to participate in Midwestern identity as opposed to saying gatekeeping Midwestern identity.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that is at the heart of what it means to be Midwest. You know, I do think that Midwest nice thing is what the Midwest is at its best, and it is inviting and welcoming all sorts of folks in. And even if you're not from here, you know, you can easily become part of the culture, as a lot of cultures have done. They've come in and they've been accepted, and they brought so much to the table.
Talking to Charlie Behrens, comedian, host of the Manitowoc Minute, author of the book, The Midwest Survival Guide. We're talking about what it means for something to be Midwestern. What defines the Midwest, Wisconsin, and the other Midwestern states that are out there, too? And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your answers. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel is with us next in Fort Atkinson. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I think there are a couple things that make the Midwest what it is. I think quality beer, and then freshwater sports and casseroles, because casseroles aren't always hot.
All right. What's your favorite casserole, Rachel, hot or otherwise? I'm putting you on the spot.
Cold tuna casserole with Lay's chips.
Cold tuna casserole with Lay's. Oh, I love it. Rachel, thanks a lot for that. Yeah, the fresh water. I mean, so much. We have the Great Lakes. If you don't have Great Lakes, you've got a bunch of lakes in the Midwestern states. That and the beer are big parts of it for Rachel, Charlie.
Yeah, and, you know, actually one of my favorite videos I ever did was where I was showing people how to water ski with beer. And that, you know, it's not something I recommend you do, but if you are interested, I got a tutorial for you on that situation. So you even drop the ski. But yeah, you look at the skiing, the tubing, and also not just tubing behind the boat, but putting a tube in a river and doing that lazy river. That's fantastic as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rachel, at 800-642-1234. Charlie, I assume you hear from people all over the country, even outside the Midwest. What are some of the things, the questions people ask you, or the things that seem to confuse people who aren't from the Midwest about what we do here?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about the weather, about how can you live in a place that, you know, that's so cold half the year, you know, and the answer is it's more than half the year, to be quite honest with you. So and furthermore, I don't know, but we do find ways to have a lot of fun, even in the months that are not as comfortable. I mean, ice fishing is the perfect Midwest example of, you know, taking the frozenness of the entire region, saying, you know, when God gives you ice, cut a hole in it and see if you can't get yourself a walleye or something. And we find plenty, even just swimming, the polar bearing stuff, you know, that started here. Did it actually start here? I don't know, but I'm just going to claim it anyway. You know, we literally cut a hole in the ice and said, let's go swimming. We surf here in the winter, in the UP on Superior and Lake Michigan. Sheboygan's got better waves than Malibu, you know, and you can only surf in the colder months.
Let's go back to our callers. Dennis is with us in Oconomowoc. Dennis, hi.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good. What's your story, Dennis?
So, you know, I'm originally from New York, and I moved here, you know, for work to Oconomowoc, and get a little used to the, you know, the fish frying stuff. I love walleye. The beer is great. I was wondering if Charlie had any other suggestions other than cheese and beer and brats, you know, casseroles. What else can we eat here?
And, Dennis, I got to ask, first of all, how long have you been in Oconomowoc from New York?
A little less than 2 years, so it's about a year and 9 months or so.
Okay, all right. So advice for Dennis to expand his Midwest horizons. Welcome, a couple years late, welcome to Wisconsin, Dennis. Charlie, any advice for Dennis?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, no, I was waiting for the lead up on that. That was my bad.
That was my bad.
Oh, sorry about that.
I stepped on you there, buddy.
Four times.
Yeah.
Now look at you being very Midwest. Yeah, there's a ton of different stuff here. I mean, first of all, the supper club is a Midwest staple, and that you got the prime rib, you got the venison truffle. Also, there are a lot of great indigenous dishes around. And if you can get yourself to an intertribal powwow, you can have some of those. There's a great chef in Minneapolis, Chef Ye Vang. And he's Hmong, and he's got a great kitchen with it, which has amazing Hmong dishes. So there's so many different culinary experiences here. And really, again, there's influence from Hmong and Somalia, Germany, Ireland. And so there are all these different traditions that are here if you just look for them.
Dennis, thanks a lot. Hope that helps. Comedian Charlie Behrens is with us, host of the Manitowoc Minute, looking at what makes stuff Midwestern, what things are the most Midwestern, and we are looking for your answers to those questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What people or places or things or ideas are the most Midwestern to you? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with comedian Charlie Behrens, author of the book, The Midwest Survival Guide. He's with us today to help us sort out some inspiration here. The Washington Post analyzed what objects, animals, places, and ideas are the most Midwestern. We want your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Phillips. Paul, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Paul?
Well, if you're from the Midwest, you got to know your sausages, your bratwurst, your knackwurst, your jackwurst, summer sausage, Polish sausage. You know, I have a brother who moved to Oklahoma. I sent him a care package because he lives in a sausage desert.
What, do you have a favorite, Paul?
Oh, my God. Right now, we're about ready to cook some Asagio cheese bratwurst that we're made locally here.
Well, that sounds great. I'll stop by after the show, Paul. Thanks a lot. Charlie, favorite sausages?
You know, my Uncle Tom used to host these cookouts back in the day, and he would always go to a local butcher in Milwaukee, and he got these Hungarian sausages, and oh my gosh, Now, you got to watch out for them because they're on the spicier side of life. So you get one of those things, you're going to have that heartburn. You're going to have the meat sweats at 2 a.m., especially if you mix it with a beer or two. So you got to be careful on that side. But going down, they're fantastic.
That sounds great. Can I make a confession to you, Charlie? I don't know if I've said this on the air before. So when I first moved here, I'm from Michigan, like I said. I had eaten bratwurst in my life, but it wasn't a thing to call them brats there. So I get here, and there's all these restaurants with brats in their name. Yeah. What? Brats? What, have some brats with your beer, or give your beer some brats? Brats? Yeah, I was surprised by this, that shorthand. I think now John Madden, when he was doing NFL calling, he popularized brats a little more. This was one that surprised me, Charlie.
You saying that also, it's kind of like the fish fry thing. I forget that they don't call them brats outside of, and that I didn't realize that was a Wisconsin thing either until this moment right now. So I got to start opening my eyes a little bit more when I tour outside of the state, because and see if I can't find a brat house somewhere in Michigan. You know, the other thing is once you focus on it, then you see it all over the place.
Exactly.
But that's wild. And you don't have there's no shame in that. You know now, and that's all that's important.
Oh, I do. I take it for granted now. Let's go back to our callers. Clifford is with us in Pewaukee. Clifford, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your Midwestern stuff, Clifford?
Well, I drive a lot, and I noticed there's a lot of deer.
Oh,
they may
be
laying on the side of the road, but, oh, boy, there's a lot of deer.
Deer as a big defining element of Wisconsin, Clifford. Whether you're looking at them or hunting them or eating them, deer here in Wisconsin, again, I think in particular, a big part of the Midwestern idea.
Yeah, I mean, how we say I love you is watch out for deer, because they are around, you know, and you may lack the emotional capacity to tell your loved ones I love you, but you will tell them to drive safe now and watch out for deer. And I'll also add, have a buck knife in your brat holder, which some people call their sunglasses holder. Because if you do hit one and it's fresh, that is some zero carbon footprint way to fill your freezer with some meat right there.
Clifford, thanks for that. Katie is calling from on the road right now. Katie, hello.
Hi.
What do you have? What is your Midwestern defining idea?
Well, so I'm from Ohio originally, and I moved to Boston 7 years ago, and my husband and I are currently on a road trip to Minnesota for a family reunion. And the thing I miss the absolute most about living in the Midwest is how friendly everyone is, because they are not friendly at all in Boston.
Oh, no. What does that look like in Boston, Katie? How does that manifest itself?
Sorry. You cut out a little bit.
Yeah. What does that unfriendliness in Boston look like?
I don't know. Just everyone's kind of a little more like cold and closed off.
Oh,
and
no.
Sometimes people like to blame it on the weather, maybe, but I mean, it's
because we don't have that here.
Minnesota. Right, exactly. Yeah,
Katie, thanks a lot for the spread the friendliness, the Midwestern friendliness in Boston. Charlie, what do you think? Friendliness as a defining factor of the Midwest?
Well, I think it is certainly friendly, and I think that's it's got its roots in a few different places. A lot of folks are just trying to find a way to get themselves out of purgatory earlier. So they're going to, it's a do nice first, ask questions later kind of place. And I like that about it.
Katie, thanks. I hope Boston warms up to you a little bit. We're talking to Charlie Behrens from the Manitowoc Minute, author of the book, The Midwest Survival Guide. We are talking about what defines the Midwest, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Jim in Watertown is with us now. Jim, what says the Midwest to you?
Well, Katie kind of took it. It's your personality, man. I was a boiler maker. I'm from Maryland, and I'll tell you what, I've never seen a warmer set of people than you got out here, but I do have one rub.
Uh-oh.
Why do you call a bubbler, a water fountain, a bubbler? It took me a daggone year to figure out what y'all were talking about.
Jim, thanks a lot for that. I got to say, Charlie, I knew I was a Wisconsinite the first time I was traveling. I was visiting my brother in California, and I was somewhere, and I asked somebody at a counter, hey, do you have a bubbler? And I didn't do it on purpose, but we've talked about the history on the show. Bubbler, there's like Wisconsin and then like a couple little places in Maine or something like that. Bubbler is a defining word here.
Yeah, it's I think it's Wisconsin, then Rhode Island, and actually somewhere in Boston, they also call it, but they say bubbla with an A. but, you know, I think it comes from the Kohler company, which based in Kohler, Wisconsin, obviously. A lot of toilets. Check your toilet. If it's Kohler toilet, that came from right here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But I think they also, back in the day, made the first what some call water fountain. Obviously, for us in Wisconsin, water fountain—that's a place you get change for the meter. But no, the bubbler is—it comes from that name, I think. In a lot of ways, like Kleenex is the name for tissue, and it just sort of stuck.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Bill joins us now in Madison. Bill, what are your examples of Midwest living?
Well, I got a couple. Two, I'm not sure about, but one, corn. Mm-hmm. Seems pretty obvious all around the Midwest. Easy one. The other two, my friends in Germany thought I was joshing them, but tree frog and flying squirrel, are those Midwest only, or are they other places too?
I don't know. Like, do we have a lot of flying squirrels here, Charlie? That's not leaping to mind for you. They jump around a lot, but flying squirrels, I don't know.
You know, yeah, I'd actually be curious to look into that myself, because I've seen a lot of squirrels, and they are good jumpers, and you would think that they'd have wings. And I know flying squirrels exist, but I can't tell you I've seen one in the flesh in recent memory. And then the tree frog situation, that I'm also not sure about.
Yeah.
So now and that's the nice thing about the Midwest. It's like the onion that you got in the bottom of your crisper that you forgot about, you know, and it's starting to grow, you know, outside of there. But you start peeling back these layers and you realize that there's so much to the Midwest you never even knew. You could live here your whole life and learn something new. So I'll do a little research on that and figure it out. But thanks for bringing that up.
Bill, thanks. Our producer, Emily Burdett, says there are flying squirrels in northern Wisconsin, at least. I'll have to investigate further. Bachelor, we got time for at least one or two more callers. Aaron is with us in Madison. Aaron, hello.
Hey guys, how you doing? I wanted to give you two things. I got a game and I got a jingle. All right. So first off, the game, Euchre, the card game. Mm-hmm. Lived a lot of places, and the way I always connect with others in the Midwest, from the Midwest, is by playing Euchre. Often Michigan, Wisconsin, seems to be a big Michigan thing, although their rules aren't as great as ours in Wisconsin. Then the jingle, I'll give you the jingle quick. And then you can probably fill in the blank. It goes like this. Dun, 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 boom.
Go, Pack, go. Boom. I think you're working on there. Aaron, thanks a lot for that. So the Packers, let's talk the cards, though, Charlie. Euchre, I'll see your Euchre. I'll raise you a pinochle and maybe a sheep's head. Card games in the Midwest, Charlie. Do you play any of them?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I'm actually, during the pandemic, the way my family held it together, you know, seeing each other and whatnot, was by doing Zoom sheep's head games. So we'd get on Zoom and we'd hang out, and then we'd play online sheep's head and Euchre as well. And there are actually these tournaments all around. Sheep's head is much more just Wisconsin, mm-hmm. but Euchre is more Midwest, and they have tournaments all around the country for Euchre. And that's kind of the cool thing about the Midwest, is that, you know, wherever you go, there we are. There are Midwest people all over, and they're very proud of the culture, and they bring it with them.
Charlie, thanks again for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it was a blast. I appreciate you having me.
That's Charlie Behrens, comedian. He hosts the Manitowoc Minute, author of the book The Midwest Survival Guide, with us today, helping us sort through a Washington Post analysis of what places and things are the most Midwestern.